through being on the other line, screaming, yelling, swearing at Ernest Sagan, basically calling, I think at one point in time, he said, Canadians don't know how to set up a computer network. That's not true. I found out that that's not true. But in any event, generally it's not a good idea to scream and holler and swear at your supervisor. And end of that story, at least the brief part of it, is that on December 3rd, after that event, Christopher Ruby gets suspended. So they think about it for a little while, they talk about it, they look at some of his past incidents, sort of anger management issues that he's had over the course of his time with Canadian Pacific, and what do they decide to do, Paul?
They decide to suspend it, right? Because as Tim mentioned before, they have, for CPR, when you register that window of time to which you're going to be an upgrade, it's vitally important. Why? Because they didn't want their network to go down, and if it were to go down during that window, at least they would have a heads up, they can mitigate the problem. So from their standpoint, and Ernest eventually told us, it was a fireable offense. You schedule a 2-hour block, you need to work within that 2-hour block. You can't deviate from that block. Things happen, they're out of your control when they happen, but you can't decide on your own merits that, hey, forget the 8 to 10 window, I'm just gonna start that 7. And that was a problem with Chris, because they wanted him to stick to that block he had asked for, and because he was so smart, he chose to go ahead and he tried to do the 8 to 4, it didn't work out. Then he tried to do it the next day. Again, he wouldn't adhere to that window of time. So he was suspended.
Okay, and then I didn't ask my question that hard. What happened 12 days later?
12 days later, during the suspension, he was instructed, hey, don't use your computer with the exception of doing a financial return for his money, requesting he get payment for when he traveled for that upgrade. Besides that, don't use your computer, don't access the network. And since he worked at that location in Minneapolis, they said, physically, don't come to work. Right? You're suspended. Stay home, don't come. During that 12-day window, what does he do? Someone who's smarter than everyone else decides, I'm going to come to work. So he continuously tries to go to the office, scanning in, trying to tell people he was unaware that he was suspended.
And so his supervisor and others at Canadian Pacific decide he's going to be terminated. And on December 15th, they place a call to him. They're all up in Canada. He's in Minneapolis. And he's at his home in Minneapolis to make a phone call and tell Chris Ruby he's going to be terminated. Chris Ruby says, hey, instead of terminating me, can I resign? So the Canadians, as I said, super nice people, they think about it, they say, you can resign rather than being terminated. And so he submits a letter of resignation, he's done, and they tell him, turn in all of your equipment. So Ruby is at home, he's got his laptop, he's got his remote access device. Anybody here thinking there might be a problem? Okay. So on December 15th, he's fired. Generally speaking, people don't love to be fired. And so he's got a way of getting back into the system. And of course, on December 17th of 2015, while he still has his laptop and his remote access device, he gets onto his laptop computer in Minneapolis. He logs into the computer network in Ogden, and he begins to do a number of things to those switches. So he was a guy who, as a network engineer, had an admin access to the switches. He was a guy who programmed the switches before, and this is something he was doing both at switches in the United States as well as the switches in Canada from time to time as part of his job. So he knew his way around the network, he knew his way around the switches, he knew the architecture of it, he knew the programming of it. And so what he did when he got onto those switches was to remove all of the existing admin accounts, reset all the admin passwords for the switches, delete a number of files that would have contained backup information to be able to reset those passwords, which had the effect of locking Canadian Pacific admin employees, network engineers, and the network staff out of those switches. So it didn't take the network down. So it just made it such that if there were any issues that came up, if they needed to upgrade the switches, if they needed to change any of the programs or make any sorts of changes or do any troubleshooting on the network, they wouldn't have been able to get back in. And so, because it didn't shut things down, because it wasn't evident that there was a problem, they didn't figure it out until January 6th of 2016. I should say 16 on it. I apologize. when they try to access the network switches at Canadian Pacific and they can't get it. The passwords don't work. And so at that point in time, law enforcement is not yet involved. We learned this after the fact. But at that point in time, they do everything they can to try to figure out what's going on. They try, everybody who's had some sort of system access to the switches, try your password, try to get access to it. They're unable to do it. And they even call Chris Groupie. And they call him and say, hey, do you know what might have happened? Do you have any old passwords we can try? And there were staff at Canadian Pacific that were so close to Chris Groupie at this time. He says, no idea what happened. Sorry, I can't help you. And ultimately, they're not able to get in to the switches at all. Now, this can be a huge problem. As I said, if there's a problem, they have to troubleshoot it, they have to deal with anything, and they can't get in, they basically are going to have to shut down the entirety of the railway system, because a lot of the safety measures that are on there and communication systems that are on the network are linked to that computer network. So they try to do what they can to figure out how to get in, including calling the manufacturer of the switches, Cisco, who says, okay, well, what you could do, what you try to do is shut down, you know, what does every IT professional tell you to do when you've got a problem on your computer? Shut it down, reboot. And so that was it. Shut it down, reboot, and hope that the programming on that on the switches reverts back to the original program. That there will be stored information on the switches that will come back, and then the original program. So they do it. On January 7th, shut down the switches. And before they shut down the switches, they actually go and find backup versions of the code. So they've got it on laptop computers. They're actually plugged into the switches in the room where the switches exist. They shut them down and they switch the switches back on and hold their breath and wait and hope that it comes back online. And if it doesn't, they're going to have to take a few hours to be able to reprogram the switches to their original configurations. Luckily for Canadian Pacific, when they reboot, comes back online, and they're able to get access to the switches at that point in time. First thing they do when they get access to the switches is what fall?
You want to go download logs. So there were local logs stored on those core switches, up in core switch 1, up in core switch 2. The hope being, once they got those switches back up and running, they were able to download logs, and then they could see, put together that sequence of events, who was in those switches on that time, approximate date and time prior to the incident happening, who was, what were they doing in the second?
Basically looking to the logs to see what had happened prior to them not being able to get access to the system. And when they went into those logs, they could see that some things had happened. So it indicated the logs that they were most interested in were the logs from those two network switches in Ogden. And what they did when they were looking for that is they were trying to gather up whatever kinds of information they could. And so this is a diagram, it's a very crude diagram of network access using remote access point. You can see that on this diagram, it shows that to get on via laptop, you use a RAP, which is a remote access point manufactured by Aruba. Probably people here are familiar with that device. Going through the internet, go through the corporate firewall into the system, go through a series of things, including a DHCP server, which names the user as they come onto the network, identifies them, and then and only then can a person who accesses the network remotely get to those network switches, which you see kind of at the bottom and middle of the diagram. And so, first thing that they're doing is looking at the logs that come off those switches, and as they're going forward, Canadian Pacific starts looking at whatever other logs that they can get information out of. And one of the logging the functions that they had that was known to information security at Canadian Pacific, but not very well known by employees of Canadian Pacific, was that on every device that could access the network, there was a piece of software, a monitoring piece of software that is monitoring software that is created by the company CrowdStrike. It's called Falcon Host. And it basically logs some system processes and then dumps it out to a cloud point that is maintained by CrowdStrike and you can see what's going on with respect to the devices that are connected to the network. So that one log was the Falcon host logs. The other log that they were able to get access to were the DHCP logs, which is for people that are, all you want to describe just generally what a DHCP server does.
Sure, so it's within the network at this point. Chris was coming in from outside his home IP address. He wanted to go into the network, so the DHCP says, hey, who are you? Let me authenticate you. This computer name is recognized. The MAC address that you're using is recognized. If you're going to be inside our network, you need a private IP. We're going to delegate this private IP to you. So thereafter, that DHCP host delegates that private IP to this box, like to this outside computer name, like to this MAC address. Go forward and do what you need to do internally on our network because you're a real user, privileged user.
Sort of like a name badge for people that are getting on the network, and then every time you go to a different place on the network, you have to identify yourself using the name badge. That's sort of how I'm explaining it to a jury that may not be technically understanding of how that works or internal IP address works. Then there were also logs from the switches themselves. And so first thing that when Canadian Pacific is trying to recreate what took place, they go and get information from the Falcon host logs. And one of the things they learned from those Falcon host logs is that at a time when those logs showed that the admin passwords had been changed, I'll show you some of those logs in a moment, they could show that that took place on December 17th of 2015. You could see that there were admin passwords that were changed, some files that were deleted. A lot of things took place on those affected switches on December 17th. So they looked and concluded that on that date and time, there was SSH activity involving a user that is identified as GRU0040 within the Canadian Pacific system. And for those of you who don't know what SSH activity, raise your hands if you know what SSH activity is. Okay, so I will be explaining it to very few people in the room, but it's essentially what that is a way of connecting to, using remote access and connecting to the switches themselves, getting a user interface to be able to get access to and change the programming to the virtual machines within the switches. And so what the Falcon Host log showed was that on December 17th, there were 18 SSH launches using a .exe program that created the secure shell to 15 different unique locations. And the unique locations in this case were the virtual machines within the switches. And some of those switches were the ones that were changed in order to lock Canadian Pacific out of those two octave core switches in Canada. So that was meaningful. The GRU0040 number was meaningful because there were a couple of things that were correlated with those logs. One of them included the username as well as a device name or number. And that the combination of letters and numbers starting with 7SC was a unique identifier that was associated with the device that was used by Canadian Pacific. So every device that could connect to the network got the device number. And so they were able to figure out that that device linked back to a computer that was belonging to Chris Scruton. So there were, you can see that this is the laptop computer itself. It's got that device number that's on it externally, and there was also a way that was recorded internally. And then we went to the distribution, inventory record for the computers that were distributed, and concluded that it came back to Christopher Groovy. Sort of a point I should mention is that on December 17th, all this stuff happened. They didn't figure out it had happened until January 6th. But also on December 17th, what did Chris Groovy do with his computer?
By the end of that day, he had met with a gentleman by the name of Fred Chambers, who was an employee at Canadian Pacific, in order to turn in his computer and his Google app.
So he returned his laptop computer. Was there anything that had been done to the computer before he returned it?
Sure. Before he returned it, he had taken out that hard drive and wiped it. So he returned a brick computer with a Aruba rep at the end of the day, which would have happened obviously before the beginning of the day.
So Canadian Pacific had the computer with the device ID on it. But unfortunately, the drive had been wiped, looked at it forensically, there was nothing of forensic significance on it. I guess what is forensically significant about it being wiped, that's kind of a significant thing, but nothing in terms of connecting it up to the activities on December 17th of 2015. So this showed in the inventory record that that computer had been issued to Christopher Ruby. So we had that connection in place. And then we also, Canadian Pacific at that time looked at logs from the DHCP server. And so the DHCP server, again, shows that unique internal IP that's assigned to everybody that connects in remotely. And in fact, it has a specific designation for if you're remote access as opposed to internal access. You can, and I can't remember if it's the .220 that's on it that shows the remote access, but there's some part of that that somebody that worked at Canadian Pacific would look at it and say, oh yeah, that's a remote access internal IP. So we're able to make that connection because the DHCP server also referenced that specific device ID right there. And also had another piece of data in it, which is everyone recognizes a MAC address. This is a MAC address that was associated with the YLAN card that was in Chris Griffey's computer. So another data point connecting these things together. Now, I'm showing you all this that we were able to put together as part of the puzzle of figuring out who did it as we got to trial months later. These connections weren't always falling into place immediately in Canadian Pacific, and some of them we learned in a later time. But this is some of the data that they had available to them up front. So, again, that internal ID, I mentioned earlier that one of the first things that Canadian Pacific did was pull the logs off of the switches. And basically, they would run a printout of it, they would take they would cut it, copy it, and paste it into a notepad document, because there's no real good way of getting output other than just getting the text from a switch log. And what they were able to see on the affected switch logs is that internal IP did some things. That person who was using that internal IP did one thing, changing the admin password. It's reflected in the logs. That internal IP, which again comes back to that same computer, and that same internal ID, excuse me, if I go in here, that same internal IP address showed that it logged into 15 different BDCs on the five-bit switches. This is what a log from a Cisco switch looks like. Can everybody look at that and read it and figure out exactly what's happening? Nor could I. So, and there may be people who are very familiar with this programming language and are familiar with how this operates, but from somebody coming in as a prosecutor, even a prosecutor has a number of cybercrime cases, it still takes some time to get up to speed on it. And Paul, who's a cybercrime investigator, who actually has an engineering background and a cyber investigation background, same thing. How many times have you seen Cisco switch log output before?
I had never seen Cisco switch logs.
So, again, a learning experience for what this showed. But what we did, we were able to, when talking to people that could speak this language, we were able to learn a few things. That on December 17th, disregard the time code on there, we'll talk about that in a minute, but on December 17th, a few things happened. Change of admin password, some deletion of some admin accounts entirely, and also some deleting of some other files that were on the switches. And we found this on all of the affected switches. Basically what he had done is he had deleted all admin accounts except for one, and then had gone in and changed the admin password. So he was the only one who knew what that admin password was for the single admin account on each of the affected switches. So again, done from that same internal IP. So as I mentioned, one of the things that CPR, Canadian Pacific Railroad, did was when they figured out that there had been somebody who had gotten into their system and had done some things to the switches, at first they didn't know what was going on. They were very concerned about a potential insider attack. They didn't know how deeply into the network the person was, or persons. They didn't know if they were still in the system. All the things that anybody in information security would be concerned about how deep are they in, are they exfiltrating data, is there anything in there that we should be concerned about other than the things that we're aware of from the affected switches? And so one of the things they did was to, they had already been working with CrowdStrike because they had the monitoring software, the Falcon Host software that they worked with them on and store the network process, or the processes that took place on the computers that were connected to the network. But they also reached out to CrowdStrike to come in and assist in incident response. And so CrowdStrike comes in, starts looking at the data that is available to Canadian Pacific up front, and they're I think January 7th is the first time that CrowdStrike is brought in to take a look at this data. Is that right? Oh,
sounds about right.
And so they come in and they, through sifting through the data, they create a timeline of the attack in their incident response. And so they say, here's what happened, and here's the timeline of what took place. Great, kind of detailed, really helpful, right? Looking through it. And so here's the problem. This is wrong. So CrowdStrike came in and they did an analysis, created a timeline of the attack, but the timeline that they came up with was incorrect. And they sort of identified the source of why this timeline was wrong. And we'll talk a little bit about what that is. They recognized that it was an issue, that there were some time standard problems with respect to some of the logs, but they still came up with a conclusion. And then, not only a conclusion, but sort of a timeline of what took place. You can see this is a timeline starting at December 17th, 2015 at 12:01:07. And then a few things that are taking place, including the log on. And that log on that's on there is from the Falcon Host records. It showed that GRU0040 using device 7SCZH12 logged on at 12:01:07 UTC on December 17th. And so that was an accurate piece of data. Unfortunately, when we got to what are defined in here as the router logs, those times are wrong. And so we have I'm going through the three pages of timeline that are in that incident report. And so, you come into an investigation, we come into an investigation, we're starting to sift through data, and we look at the sort of the raw information. But we also will look at a report like this, at least initially. I probably won't do this anymore. Look at it as a reputable company, a reputable response company that has come to some conclusions. And even if we're not taking that timeline as gospel, in the back of our head, it affects our conclusions. And so why were things wrong? Well, as I mentioned to you, that these switches were the four different switches that had been accessed by Chris Grubbia on December 17th of 2015 that he made changes on. All of them were set at a different time standard. And so that's a problem because it's not uniform and it is not consistent with UTC. And so what that meant was that, and these things are sitting right next to each other, they were at different time standards. So not only were they different from the CrowdStrike UTC, they were also different from each other. And what that created for us was a bit of a problem. But for Paul, it was a little bit of a problem, and for me, understanding things was a little bit of a problem. And so Paul loves spreadsheets. He's quiet, and he loves spreadsheets. Right?
I do, yes.
Yeah. And Paul loves chapstick.
Just
a fun fact. So we had to figure out, okay, what is it that actually happened, and what was the actual timeline of the attack? And so the first thing we did was say, what was the one log, what was the one record we knew was accurate for purposes of time?
It was that Falcon Host log, so that piece of software that was input maybe at the kernel level on every laptop that CPU and bot issued out. That was always calling out to the time zone. That was UTC, and it was stored on a separate segregated server. So we took that time to be legitimate and as true and accurate as we possibly could.
That's basically internet time, right? And so we started that as a point of reference. And then we were able to use the Falcon Host data that showed each one of those SSH connections to the BDCs. And we could see from the Falcon Host data when the user was secure shelling into the BDC. We can then look at the BDC logs and say when it was that there was a secure shell connection into the BDC logs. And then based on that, figure out, okay, that means it's for this BDC, we can see in the BDC logs it's this time. We know that that time is the same as whatever it is at UTC. And so Paul created, see if I can do this better, a spreadsheet that showed a few different things. And I'm sorry for the people on that side, maybe Paul, you can point to this on that side, but what it showed on one side was, go to the top, a UTC offset. We had to figure out that offset. And you can see with Falcon Host, the offset was zero. But Ogden switch one, we concluded based on those logs that it was 7 hours off. And you think, well, is that mountain time? Is that central time? It was neither. And so even though it was in Ogden, you'd think it would be on mountain time, it's just 7 hours off UTC, which at least was helpful because it was consistently 7 hours off UTC. And it's a nice round number, 7 hours. Ogden switch two, a little bit different. Turns out that Ogden switch two was 4 hours and 8 minutes offset from UTC. So I wouldn't have known what that is in decimal points until Paul figured it out, but it's 4.13 repeating. So we were able to show that, and we wanted to show not only what the time that meant in UTC, but really importantly, you can see that there is a column there for central time, because we needed to show what it looked like when Chris Grubbe was sitting at his laptop computer in his living room in Minneapolis, and what the timetable was, because we also needed to compare that time to the 3 hours later when he shows up and drops off his laptop computer on the same day and work back from it. Because if we had been using the source time on there, it made no sense given what time he returned the computer. So it was helpful to be able to correlate all those things. So, Paul, was this easy?
No, it was not.
was it obvious also?
It wasn't obvious. At least with this first course switch, it's nice because it's reasonable to assess if someone's going to adjust the time zone and be off. It's going to be a time zone adjustment in whole numbers, right? 7 hours, 6 hours, 5 hours. That at least I can rationalize. This makes sense. But to go with a different course switch that's off by 4 hours and 8 minutes, this part was very odd to me. So that obviously led to confusion. And kind of mucked up, right? So when we're looking at it from that standpoint, we wanted to point out here's the sequence of events that's going on in central time in Minnesota based on Chris returning the computer and the newly returned the computer around this date and time. We needed to put that sequence of events together that would make sense. And so unfortunately this kind of threw a little bit of a wrench in the gears.
And again, we've kind of, you know, for purposes of the presentation, simplified a lot of what we found, but understand that those logs, the switch logs in particular, were hundreds of pages of printout. And isolating the things that mattered required us to kind of go through and figure out what it was that was being done, what the programming language from the Cisco switches meant, how it would be reflected on a different log, and then put it all together. This was just a correlation of Falcon Host logs and the switch logs. We didn't even incorporate those DHCP server logs that were in there, which is another data point that's helpful to us, but at least with respect to being able to show in a timeline fashion what was happening in Minneapolis starting at 7:16 a.m. in Minneapolis time and concluding a couple hours later, that was something that we were able to do through a spreadsheet format. Again, Paul likes spreadsheets, I like pictures. We eventually turned this into pictures because I need to see pictures. So, I guess the takeaway from all this for everybody here is going to be what we talked about in the last few minutes of the presentation, which is how could this have become, how could this have been an easier investigation? And from my perspective, there are two things that I would have liked to have a time machine to go back and get. And one of them is, and I would suggest this for anybody that is doing some sort of incident response. The first thing you want to do, if you're coming in from the outside, if you don't know the network, if you don't know how your servers are set up, if you don't know the architecture that you're dealing with, get somebody who does to make a diagram like this. Because until I understood, sort of in broad strokes, what the architecture looked like, I didn't know the data sources. I didn't know where I could grab information that would be helpful to our investigation. It was like, I don't, when I say I mean the two of us. And interesting thing about the kind of investigations that we do, a lot of law enforcement prosecutor relationships are, law enforcement does the investigation, they finish, they bring a bunch of reports to the prosecutor, prosecutor looks at it and then prosecutes the case. And there's a divergence in that. Cyber investigations, very different than that. We start working on a case together from the very beginning of it. We're both trying to figure things out. We're talking to each other. We're trying to unravel things. And so when you have an incident, if you are not somebody who has a base level of understanding of all the potential data sources out there, you want to get one person or five people or whatever it takes to get this type of information to you. Because had I known this type of information from the very beginning, the very first thing I would have said is, hey, can we have your firewall logs, right? And so by the time I got to that point and asked for the firewall logs, they were gone. They had not maintained the firewall logs, and so we didn't have anything to show that. That would have been really, really helpful, because what it would have shown, probably, unless the guy was using a VPN or some other thing to log in, which I don't think he was, would have shown that it would have linked back to Chris Grubbe's home internet account. And that would have been a pretty nice piece of data for us when prosecuting him. Might not have had to do all the sort of piecing together that we ended up doing. So this, I say this because if we did get some other logs, but the firewall logs would have been extremely helpful. And by the time I understood the network architecture, they didn't exist anymore. Because logging information, logs take up space, and every organization has a different timetable for doing normal maintenance and overwriting of logging information. So that's one thing. The other thing, and this I think is kind of obvious from all of this, and I'll just skip to the recommendations portion of it, Paul, were there a couple of good things that came out of that CrowdStrike report?
Absolutely.
And what were they?
The time zone synchronization, and then the idea of doing central logs versus a local log, or even if you do local logs, have it backed up centrally. So you can go to one server, and that server is going to be where all these logs of value come into play.
And so, it would have been great to be able to just have a central repository of all logging information and be able to look at it. And I think if somebody was doing that and looking at the central repository of logging information for network information, you'd be able to see, oh, there's a problem here because the logs that we're getting for the switches are not consistent with the DHCP server, which, by the way, the DHCP server was also running on UTC. So it was helpful in terms of that correlation. But it would have shown, if you had centralized logging, that you had disparities between that logging information. So central logging and time synchronization of logging are two huge takeaways. And it's not something that you necessarily would think about ahead of time, and you really only start thinking about it after the fact when you're trying to correlate that information. So as I always like to have a couple of things that I walk away from if people are doing incident response: understand your network architecture, understand where everything is located, make sure you're able to get it before it gets deleted, and if at all possible, have it synchronized by time. Got anything else in terms of takeaway, Paul?
Sure. Our takeaway from my standpoint was Canadians, it was really easy to work with. But as time went on, a lot of people who were involved in the situation had left the company. So when we were getting ready for trial, we were trying to find and locate the interview and talk to people who were no longer Canadian Pacific employees. So what I'd advocate for a company or any company, when you have an incident, right, get on the front end who the players are, anybody who's involved, obviously their name, their phone number, their personal phone number, personal email, in case in the future they were to leave the company, you still might, we want to reach out to them and ask, hey, what happened during this incident. Besides the people who are involved and ways to get a hold of them, if you have one person who's the primary keeper of all data, to include emails, to include logs, to include DHCP logs, whatever, that person should keep that data. He or she should have a backup that keeps the same data segregated on a USB drive or on a hard drive somewhere else, right? In case that first piece is lost or damaged or dies, right, at least you have a backup copy. And in case that primary were to leave the company, the secondary email becomes the primary. That's the person who can testify. I was there on this date and time. All these logs were given to me. I know them to be true and accurate to the best of my ability. Here's all the people who were involved. And then you would add a new secondary. It's really nice to have a name and a point of contact at a company and then have a backup for that, because when we were working with them, it was not always easy to find all the employees involved. And then some of the people who were involved, right, they worked through email, but they didn't segregate logs and keep them separate. They kept them as attachments to email. So it was a little bit harder for them to go back and try to remember something that happened months before or a year before. It would be much easier, in my opinion, if they segregated a lot of that stuff and saved it off on a hard drive somewhere and stored it in a closet to be used if needed.
So I would take one more thing away from that, which is Paul got contacted by Canadian Pacific in March of 2016. And so that's at that point we're starting to come into the investigation. And by March of 2016, those Falcon Host logs that we talked about, they had a 30-day retention period for the Falcon Host logs. And so by the time we got involved in the investigation, they were already deleted. And so luckily, because I don't know if anybody noticed it, but you could see that when we were pointing out Falcon Host information, it was coming out of an email from an employee at Falcon Host. We did not have the raw Falcon Host logs. We didn't have that information. We were luckily able to dig through, and again, we dug through a bunch of information in a bunch of emails and eventually found that the email with the Falcon Host logs attached to it, but they weren't the raw logs. And curiously, incident response company does an incident response report. I would say if you work for an incident response company, keep the raw data that is the backup to any conclusions that are in an incident response. Because when we went to CrowdStrike, I said, well, presumably you have all the data that underlies your report, and the answer was no. So that was an issue, and it gets to this point, which is for those folks who work for companies where you might at some point in time want to reach out to law enforcement for some sort of an incident. It's helpful, who does tabletop exercises for incident response? How many of you do tabletop exercises for incident response include in that who in law enforcement we should call? For those of you who don't do tabletop exercises, who work in an organization where it might benefit from it, I can't encourage you to do tabletops strongly enough, and I also can't encourage you strongly enough to have an idea of who in law enforcement you might want to call. We're lucky in Minneapolis. We have very good relationships with a lot of the InfraGuard members in Minnesota. We do outreach pretty routinely to companies big and small, to universities, to the public sector areas. And so I would say that at least in Minneapolis, FBI, and even to a certain extent myself, are well known to both lawyers who represent people in incident response, as well as the companies and other entities that might have it. But if you're putting together some sort of an incident response, knowing who to call, and knowing, frankly, when you would want to call law enforcement, as opposed to trying to make that decision on the fly, is a really good idea. I have heard I'm sure this is not scientifically provable, but it makes sense roughly, that people's IQ goes down 10 points during a traumatic situation, like an incident response. And so it is really good to have muscle memory. It's really good to have practice things ahead of time and to know when you are responding to something, when it would be helpful to call law enforcement, when the C-suite of your organization would be comfortable with calling law enforcement, and then really who it is that you would want to talk to in that situation. So, any questions before we wrap things up? I think we're on the, got a couple of minutes. Yeah?
What was his intent, just to do disruption, and did he think he wasn't going to get caught?
He never said what his intent was, because we tried him, he didn't testify, he was convicted. I would say he was pissed off and wanted to do something malicious, I mentioned they called him on January 6th, and so if he had just said, I was making some changes, maybe here's a password you could try to get in, If he had done that right away, there would have been no prosecution. So he had time to think about it. He does it on the 17th. He has time to think about it. What he wanted to do, I think, was embarrass his supervisors. And he was angry. And our concern in all of this is, you know, it turns out that there was not a lot of damage done. It turns out that there was some person hours that were attributable to responding to the attack. They had to pay CrowdStrike for coming in and doing the incident response. And so did they lose a lot of money on it? No. Was the potential for damage substantial? Yes. And our calculus in terms of whether this be, you know, we have prosecutorial discretion. We have discretion of who to charge and who not to charge. And what we talked about was, here's a guy who has sophisticated skills because he's a pretty skillful network engineer. And because of his skills, and when he gets hired somewhere, he's given trusted access to computer networks. And it's important for people who are going to potentially hire this guy to know what he's capable of doing. And also there should be that consequence. So that's why we end up prosecuting him.
Okay. I think it's very telling. When you saw the graphic, and there's two data centers, one in Ogden and one in Minneapolis, when he was mucking around, he had access to both data centers. He went to the Minneapolis one, but he wasn't mad at Minnesota people. So he made no changes, deleted no admin accounts, didn't muck up anything. What he did was specifically, he went to the Ogden one, and that's where he deleted the accounts. He tried to wipe logs, delete this and that. So to me, it was very much retribution on his end against the Canadian people that he dealt
Yeah, go ahead. Was the determination to let him resign versus terminate him significant? Did they have a different employee separation policy on, if I'm terminating someone, I'm revoking the access, I'm giving them passwords, they all seem like that.
So here is what I learned a lot about Microsoft Access, or not Microsoft, what is Microsoft's Active Directory, thank you. So your credentials are cached. And so even though they went in and deleted his account, they took steps to lock him out, but because he had networked, he had logged into the network, it didn't change his credentials, meaning that for some kind of obscure reason, which we dug into in the trial, even though it had been taken out of the Active Directory, even though it had been steps taken to make it such that he couldn't get on the system anymore, he had cached credentials and he could get in that one last time.
So when his computer was at home, right during that window between the suspension up until the 17th when he returned his computer, his computer was off. It was a brick. It was turned off. It wasn't connected to any network. They make those changes to Active Directory, which are on their network. His computer doesn't know that. When he first turns it on the 17th before he returns it, what is it asking for? It's asking for his local username, user password. He still has that and still works. Once he turns it on, he gets into his computer, then he goes through that wrap, that Aruba wrap. And that's the first time he's starting to call out to Canadian Pacific's network. When he's starting to call out that, my understanding, that Active Directory didn't reject him, it allowed him to get on, and that DHCP server said, this is a computer I recognize based on the serial number. This is an MAC address that's accepted on our network. I'm gonna give him a local IP. And once he got his local IP, he was using Kitty, the remote terminal, an RTA in order to access those core switches. So Active Directory at that point might have updated, but at that point he was already on the network because his local credentials on the computer let him boot up, and then it allowed him to connect to the network, and everything from that Aruba to that DHCP server acknowledged that this computer is a legitimate computer to be on this network. Go ahead and give him an IP and let him rock on.
And I would say, so it's not like the termination versus resignation was the difference. It's that I think they believe they took steps to get him off the system and then ask him to return the laptop computer. And the problem is those steps were not effective. You had a question back there? Yeah.
So how difficult would your job have been if he would have deleted his logs as he passed out of the network? Deleted his other logs, DHCP, Active Directory?
I don't know that he would have been able to delete the DHCP logs. I don't think he, and this is a, you know, the access for this network was isolated. So he had access to the switches and he could have deleted, and it actually appeared that he did try to delete some of the files that he had on the switches. There was some speculation also at one point in time, as he was on there, his screensaver could have come up, and then when he tried to go back in to get into the system, he wouldn't be able to get back in because the Active Directory would have updated and his credentials would have changed. And so it's not clear that he didn't try to do that, but he wouldn't have been able to deal with the DHCP server, and he, as far as we know, had no idea about the Falcon host login.
One of the recommendations is especially important for small and medium businesses, you need to segregate those responsibilities. And when you only have one person that does network, server, and firewall configurations, you have all the keys to the kingdom of one person.
Look, I think that, like in every incident, hindsight's 20/20, and so would they have done something different? Like, for example, set up December 15th, you're terminated, and you need to come and bring your computer in today, or send somebody to your house and grab it. They probably would have done that. The road would have done something different with the access. You learn through experience sometimes. Yeah.
Common practice on, especially the core network, is to synchronize those switches. I mean, that's just standard setup with your time. Is there any evidence in there that he changed time settings there to try to obfuscate?
No.
Yeah. In the logs, it showed that he tried to delete some sort of shipping routes. Is that significant at all? Is there a shipping routes on TXT or something like
that? I never found that in contact with that text file.
It's just the name of whatever the text file that he was getting rid of. I think what he was doing, we thought from some of the files that he was deleting, is that he had full configurations that were saved on the switches that he had programmed himself. He was deleting those. And he was deleting, his own access and admin account that he had created called Park and Spark with his own access to it, which would allow him to get quicker access to it. He deleted all of those on as well, basically deleting his footprints from previously being on the system, but not deleting all of his footprints.
What was the sentence optimum in the lines at all?
So the sentence was not what I would have hoped. And I think part of this is we got to get a year in prison. His guidelines were 21 months. So the judge actually gave it down over variance. Part of this is, I think there's a sense sometimes by judges that people that are professionals who are now, this guy has a felony conviction, he's probably never going to be able to work in this industry again, and took that as a punishment. And that's just part of what should take place, and there should be an additional punishment and not a variance down for what that was. I think the judge also took into consideration that there was not substantial damage. But again, my perspective is that's only through luck. That's only because he got lucky and nothing really bad happened. And nothing happened during that time period between December 17th and January 6th, or January 7th, when they got back in, that was potentially catastrophic. And so the sentence was not what I would hope it would be. But I do know that a sentence for somebody that pretty highly compensated network professional up until that point, you could basically get a job easily, leave one place, get a job easily somewhere else. It's going to be a lot harder with a felony conviction for computer intrusion. Yeah.
Since the internet knows no physical boundaries, was the Canadian law enforcement involved in this, and why was the U.S. FBI because it was a Canadian company, correct?
It's a both Canadian and U.S. company. They also have operations in the United States. So it's both a United States company and a Canadian company. And the answer to why we did the prosecution as opposed to the Canadians doing the prosecution is that the law enforcement from Canadian Pacific brought the case to us. The U.S. citizen that was doing it, it was somebody who was a miscreant who was potentially going to go up and do that to other companies that he would work for in the United States. And so we looked at that as our responsibility. There are, the thing about cybercrime prosecutions too is, there are a finite number of law enforcement agencies and prosecutive agencies that are capable of doing these cases. And part of that is because they take a lot of technical knowledge, they take time to do the cases, and I'm not tooting my own horn, I'm just saying that we've developed a little bit of a specialty in prosecuting and understanding these cases. And as you can see, this was a super complicated case in terms of what he actually did. But sometimes the proof of something that's not that complicated itself becomes a little bit more complicated. And so I think, you know, in a case where, I don't know if Canadian law enforcement ever thought about prosecuting this case. We didn't deal with Canadian law enforcement. Thankfully, the Canadians at Famous and Rebel Grid were so nice and very easy to deal with and provided us information. And once we decided to prosecute, it is curiosity of international prosecution. And I can't subpoena people from Canada to come. And so they had to come voluntarily. We had both current Canadian Civic employees that testified, as well as a number of former Canadian Civic employees who just came and very nicely testified because we asked them to do so. All right. Thanks, everybody.